So diving in yet again, we said our first night, I'm going to keep stressing this over and over again, this is not just about long ago and far away. To know your heritage is to know where you are now, but not to pretend as if you lived back then. Because the fact of the matter is, I kid you not, if I were to put you in a time machine and take you back in time to the Reformation period, every single one of you would hate it in terms of the day-to-day cultural expression of things. I mean, you think that you're very obedient, loving people, but if I were to put you in 16th century Geneva, you would be don't tread on me radicals, don't tell me what to do Texans, every one of you. In the sense of, it's a very much, in the 16th century, control is the key word. Again, this is very normal. It was just standard in their day. But there were church courts throughout most of the Middle Ages and in the Reformation, where if you missed church over a certain number of weeks, they would call you in front of it and ask you where you've been. I mean, I dare any church to try that now. People might say, hey, I haven't seen you in a while, but that's as much social pressure as you're getting. This would actually be a church court in that sense. Now, that's just one example, but it's a different day, different age. They dress differently, they look differently, they sound differently, and we don't just care about old dead white guys from Europe. That's not the important thing. What ends up happening, though, is that our heritage from the Reformation is refracted and shot out across now the globe, but also in lots of different ways, which is some of that multi-denominational stuff I had on the screen right before the break. It's broken up and fragmented in little different ways. The tensions, therefore, sorry, let me relaunch this. The tensions in the Reformation, therefore, are certainly important, but they're important because they do actually come all the way down until today. What do I mean? Well, I said that the Anglican and the Reformed worlds are the hot and cold fronts that create storms in not just the 16th and 17th centuries, but even more so now, though thankfully they're less with knives and guns than they used to be. But in the time of the 17th century, it was the Civil War. The English Civil War was precipitated in large part because of this. Now, why? Well, their answer is because this was still a world of control. It was still a world where, for example, to preach any message, you had to be licensed by the church, and therefore, by extension, the state had to give enough credence for you to be able to do this. You were not allowed to meet in private. You had to register your church with the state, that type of stuff. And so what ended up happening is people got annoyed by this system. Very famously, John Bunyan is an example of this. He ends up in prison because of the story, because of the fact, rather, that he had been baptized ordained at the Baptist Church and licensed to preach only by the church, and he was therefore fined and thrown into prison. Now, I always say he wasn't tortured. He's a bit more like Otis from the Andy Griffith Show. He could let himself in and out at times. Now, I'm not saying this is a good thing. No, he wasn't a drunk. I'm just saying he could let himself in and out. That's the only analogy. But he could come and go. He was allowed to go home and visit his family at times. Here, his daughter comes to visit him. What is he doing, though? He's more of a conscientious objector. They threw him in prison, assuming that immediately he would say, all right, fine, sorry, here's a fine, pay the money, and then stop doing it. He said, no, I will not stop doing it. And he continued to say that for a number of years. That was the problem. Is this attempt to control, this attempt to press one church government down on top of England. And this, of course, was what led to civil war. And it led to the spill out of all of the denominations, and there are more, that I was talking about. Groups like Presbyterians, Congregationalists, and others. In fact, one of the main launches of this civil war occurred in Scotland, up in Edinburgh. If you've ever been to Edinburgh, Edinburgh is a city that will test the strength of your ankles, because it's like you walk straight up, it seems like, as you go up to the top, and it plateaus where the castle is there in downtown. And up on that castle mount top area, right next to it is a church. And a friend of mine at the time was a professor of theology there at Edinburgh. We're hanging out for a bit. I was passing through. And we're walking around, and he goes, "You see that church?" I can't do a good Scottish accent. But he said, "You see that church?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "That's where it happened." I said, what are you talking about? What happened? And he said, "That's where Jane Geddes threw the stool." And what happened to start the English Civil War was the king at the time, Charles I, decided that since he was king of both England and Scotland, that he was annoyed that the Scottish people had their own liturgy. And he said, am I not king of both? I mean, it's sort of a Jeroboam, Rehoboam thing. Like, you know, my little finger is as thick as my father's waist thing. I could tell them what to do. And what he does is exactly that. He imposes the Anglican form of worship down onto Scotland. And the infamous story there in Edinburgh is Jane Geddes sitting down front on a stool. As the elder, most of the people would stand and worship, but the elderly would allow to bring their stools to sit. She hears the invocation of the Anglican service, and she chucks her stool at the pastor. I always say, no matter what problems you're having as a pastor, no one's throwing things at you during the service, usually. But in this case, it was the kind of stool thrown around the world. It launched Scotland out of this idea that they're going to impose a liturgy down on top of us. So again, you see these tensions. You see it at the big scene, at the big level. You see it at the micro level with people like John Bunyan and others. All of that leads to the colonialization era, the coming of all these groups, many of these groups, to the New World. Now, the biggest thing here is you have to realize, once out from under a certain amount of persecution, there's an initial moment where some in the colonial era try to kind of territorialize their own perspective, and they push other people away from it. But almost immediately, everyone realizes that you have no capacity in the New World to impose things the way kings or whomever did back in the old. And you have what I like to call a theological melting pot. That this country did not just began to bring together different identities from Europe and other parts of the world, but increasingly, theologically, what began to happen is an equal melting pot. And you see, what this means is, if you had grown up in the 17th century in Scotland, you would not have identified, you would not have said that I go to the Presbyterian church. You're in Scotland, it's just the church. I mean, Chinese people don't call it Chinese food. You know, they just call it food in that sense. And so if you're in the 17th century, there's only one church, it's the church you go to. Come to this world, though, and you and I live in our midst a massively unique experience, even on this street where you have lots of different denominations all living as neighbors. America, in other words, is the nation of church signs in the lawn, because people walking by can't tell which group you're from until you put the sign out front, because all the churches look relatively similar, at least for most of American church history. We are a melting pot. And therefore, what ends up happening is you have, I teasingly say, changes in longitude, changes in attitude. If you remember Jimmy Buffett, that old song. This is longitude, though. As you come to the New World, there's lots of new attitudes that come in. Mark Knoll, some of you know that name, famous historian, now at Notre Dame, he was at Wheaton. He wrote a book called The Old Religion in the New World. It's a great way of putting it. Just as a question, what happened to that old-timey faith of the way the Reformation was as it moves into a world where there's now no pressure, no top-down conformity placed on people? Well, the main thing that begins to happen is the tensions within the Protestant faith that were endurable or had a certain focus in the old world, when they come to the new world, start to sometimes grow like weeds. So things that, again, that were fine in the old world maybe look not as fine in our world. And they raise up the question of tensions. The other thing I'm going to say after the lunch break, when we go to the sort of contemporary Protestantism, we're now living in a radically globalization shift in our world where the majority of Christians now no longer live in the West by name. But even the majority of Protestants, evangelical Protestants, live in another part of the world. And that raises challenges as well. How does our faith translate into different languages? For example, when I was in school at RTS, you know, as much as 20% of our student body were Korean Presbyterians. And, you know, you think Presbyterians are Scottish. You don't even think of the numbers of folks who are Korean Presbyterian. But this is true. Globally, ethnically, all things have become flat. But in this case, this is one of the first moves in after the Reformation, is you have this new world focus. And all these things begin to mix. And there are four main changes that lead to tensions. So I want to focus on these step by step. Four changes. First, there has to become, in this country, a new style of leadership in pastoral ministry. This is historically just the case, that if you were an elder or a pastor in the 16th century, the 17th century, it was a different style of authority. You didn't have people telling you what they thought you ought to be doing. You were the leader. You were supposed to just do it. And I sometimes have students that say, well, I'm a leader at my church. And I say, really? Have a building campaign. We'll see just how much they all listen to your opinion. Because what ends up happening is everyone in our world has a buy-in. And historians have a word for this. We call it the democratization of the church. That you go from a world where it was a pyramid, more or less. Leaders were supposed to lead. A pastor had been educated to a certain level, and everyone just said, well, they're the pastor. That's kind of the way. Now, again, there would be some rifts and some challenges on interpretations, but it wasn't the case like we know it, where people can just simply complain about every little thing. And I didn't really quite appreciate this until I finished seminary. I went on for, of course, more education, too much education, to do teaching. And then my friends and others went into pastoral ministry. And I started to hear stories come back about, I mean, you change the carpet, people will leave the church. Like, how dare you? My grandmother paid for that carpet. And then they run out. That kind of a thing. The language of democratization means that the style of leadership has to become not a Trojan horse. I don't want to miscommunicate that. But it has to become far more collaboration than it ever had before. Why? Well, I mean, again, the old way, the old style, it was very much leaders lead. That is the role there. This, by the way, translated to all levels of society. This is the way city councils ran. This is the way, hypothetically, if there were school boards back then, there weren't. But if there were, they'd run the same way. It was exactly very much a pyramid. Now, however, the new style of leadership that we're dealing with is very much, I can go wherever I want. I can choose whatever I want. I can be whatever I want. That Christianity, therefore, becomes a bit of a choose-your-own-adventure game, if you ever remember those books back in the day. That you just sort of choose the steps and the places you want to go. Now, the reality of this, though, is that for your typical congregation, I Googled typical congregation, and that's the picture that came up. I thought it was funny. The blonde lady on the second row is really overacting it. She's, like, really stressing watching the pastor. Anyway, it's just very funny. If you can't see it, but the guy in the back is totally asleep. Anyway, typical congregation. The typical congregation has stresses and struggles because of this. The democratization factor, the fact that everyone has a vote, a sense that they're entitled to complain, they're entitled to say their opinion, they're entitled to make their voice known. That's the cry of America. Make your voice known. And then you couple that with the fact that there is no state funding for churches, and that there are, on the same street, same neighborhood, you pass all these churches, there are so many choices, that the fact of the matter is that most people can just vote with their wheels. And so what happens in the new world is those microcosms of difference. Lutherans believe this about the sacraments, and Reformed people believe this about the sacraments. Or Anglicans believe this about worship, and Presbyterians and Congregationalists and others believe this about worship. Those differences, important as they are, become less important in this world, and what becomes more important are the differences of attractionalism. So that the Reformation from the very beginning was choose whom you will serve, you might say. Will you be a Protestant or not? Yes, okay. Well, I choose not to be Lutheran, therefore I will move to another city and become part of the Reformed faith, let's say. That happened. That is technically attractionalism, if you want to define it as such. But that is attractionalism on the big issues, the main issues. Which group are you in? Now it's the small stuff, the little stuff, the micro differences between our denominations. We can all confess our sins here. How many of us or how many of our friends have said, well, I like that church, but man, it's just slightly too loud for me, so I'm going to go to this next one down the road. Or I like that church, but I kind of want to get a new thing going on, so I'm going to go over there. Like, you get this desire to move. The other thing, though, you have to realize, and this is true throughout America's history, is the church cannot be sustained by any state funding, as I said. If you live in any other part of Europe where it is still or formerly state funding, you'll see the difference. They don't give a rip if you show up or not. Their check, therefore their 401k, is taken care of. What happens in this country, though, is we have to hustle to stay alive. I'm not trying to make it crass or worldly. What I mean is you have to actually stand in front of your church and say, folks, we're not making budget this month. Folks, we're having troubles. Or folks, thank you for your generosity. We've made budget. In fact, we can expand this part of this ministry, that kind of a thing. It's very much that you have to say, folks, stay here, help us, get on mission and figure this out. What that also means, of course, is that in Protestantism, that attractionalism, that desire to choose where you belong, means that you will eventually go to the place that makes you feel the best. And it means that what ends up happening is the vote with your wheels culture becomes the itching ears go with the celebrity style of worship culture. In other words, Protestantism did invent the context that gave us these challenges. It didn't invent the cultural issues, though, of the American context that you might say jammed steroids into the problem. So again, in the Reformation, people chose the group that they identified with. It is that way. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Again, just coming out of this book where I'm working on creeds and confessions and things. If you look at all the medieval creeds, even the ancient creeds, and then you look at the Catholic confessions and things that happened after the Reformation all the way down until today, they all have one word in them that no Protestant confession has in them. All those other things have the word anathema in them. That he who says, blah, 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 let him be anathema. I even read it when I read the Council of Trent Session 5 earlier. No Protestant confession says, let him be anathema in that type of heavy-handed way. Rather, they are, by their very definition, we believe this, let me be clear about what we believe. So that either you stop killing us in certain contexts, it's a document meant to let the establishment know that we're not heretics. But in other ways, it's saying, here is our credo, here is what we believe. And if you go, I think, to the majority of Protestant websites, that's exactly where our beliefs are under. It's who we are, our mission, our statement, our beliefs, our leadership. What is that? Do you want to come and check us out? That is the nature of where our confessions tend to be first experienced or read. Is that a bad thing? No, that's how they actually were created in many ways, believe it or not. What happened, though, is in the old world, you didn't have this... One, you didn't have the ability to even drive very far. You didn't have cars. Duh. So what you have to figure out is where can I walk, which is not that far. The invention of technology and the American culture of individualism, this kind of I will bootstrap myself throughout my own spiritual journey, means that you have all kinds of expressions of faith where you're going, why did you choose that church? Well, you know, I kind of like it. You know, you just get that kind of sense of a lack of identity, ironically, believe it or not. Now, what does that mean? It means that everybody has to figure out a way to communicate your basic identity in a way that was not there before. What that also means, though, and this is the better side of it. I've given you the negative. The better side of it, though, is American evangelicalism in the history of the church is the most nimble and the most quick to fix problems than any church tradition before. If our colleges go liberal, if our seminaries go liberal, we make new colleges, new seminaries. If the publishers stop publishing good devotional conservative works of theology or whatever, we make new publishing houses. If churches break down, get dilapidated, feel as if they have lost the message, we move down the road because no one can stop us. We have the ability to change, and we are, in that sense, the most innovative, the most committed to remaining in the faith possible. Now, of course, it means you can leave over nothing and split over nothing, and that's certainly a challenge. But I want to be half glass half full on this. The sense is that when you look at even the seminary where I have the seminaries I have taught at or other things like that, both RTS and Gordon Conwell exist because of that ability to be nimble and say, you know what? There's a need. We're going to fill it. We're going to create a new enterprise, a new seminary, and we're going to address the situation. We don't want to keep sending them off, and they come back and don't believe in Jesus anymore. That kind of a thing. And so this is the reality, is we have that ability. You know what the other part of the rest of Europe does not have? That. And therefore, they often shrivel and die on the vine in that way. So that is a tension within Protestantism. It is instinctively voluntary. I mean, there's the small called articles, which I read from Luther before. Sorry, not the small called, the small catechism by Luther, which is his best book for like young new disciples. He just says, hey, look, you know, this is what you teach your kids. Here's what you teach everybody. But it's called the smaller catechism. It's one of the first confessional things he wrote. In it, he literally says, do not impose this on anybody as if it is the law the way the papists did upon us. Rather, hold it out to them and ask them, will they be disciples? And if they say yes, then you disciple them. And it is by instinct a do not impose, do not conform, do not push in that sense at the faith, because you cannot control their faith. Rather, you woo and you attract and you say, will you come? The problem is you come to this country and it becomes a monster of a problem very often. And I don't see any way out of it. It is exactly what everybody in this country is. We were bred this way. I don't like that, so I'm going to go down. Like, that Tex-Mex place is slightly different than this Tex-Mex place, so I hate this one now, but I love this one over here. We are these micro-difference makers and these justifiers of our own discord. That is who we are. It has strengths. We're nimble. We're creative. And we will try parachurch, in church, all types of ministries, whatever will reach people for the gospel. But it also means that we can vote with our wheels in the negative sense. Secondly, there are new churches that come into the Protestant faith many generations after the Reformation that, the same with democratization, they exposed something that wasn't really there, or notice, I should say, in the beginning of the Reformation. What do I mean? Well, these new churches come along. The main one I'm going to focus on are the Methodists. But the new churches come along, and they put a spotlight on a portion of the Christian faith that had not been a portion of the Christian faith under the early Reformers. The question, of course, is this bad? Is this, you know, what is this like? What do we mean? Well, hold on. Let me just make sure you get the point here. New groups come in. They emphasize something different than the Reformers themselves. The question then becomes, and it's in many ways going to be a judgment call, but the question is do they ruin the initial expression of the faith, or are they rather exposing a weakness that was not there to begin with? That, in many ways, has always been why Methodists and Reformed, the Calvinistic denominations of all kinds in North America, have been tense at times. Now, again, not horribly so, but they don't agree. I started a podcast, a friend of mine from Cambridge days, he's a Methodist, I'm not. And it's actually kind of funny because we've been friends for years. We're not talking about necessarily all these things that divide us, but the people who listen, the three people who listen, no, I'm kidding, the couple of people, the people who listen, whether from his world or mine, go, how do you guys get along? Like, there's an assumption that a Methodist and a Reformed person should not have a podcast to be friends. It's very strange. And so what ends up happening is at the end of the day, you have new groups that come in and challenge some things. What they challenge in this case with the history of Methodism is the question of the Christian life. One of the things that is true of the Lutheran faith, that is not true of other non-Lutheran groups like Reformed and Presbyterians and others, but certainly less so than Methodists, is the question of what happens after conversion. Luther, to the end of his days, was allergic to the question of the Christian life. In fact, in systematic theology, we would say he is all about the second use of the law, meaning what he wants to say is you hold the law up as a mirror and you say, look how sinful you are with the mirror in front of you. And then you say, rest on Christ, grab Christ. As I tell my students, no one blames the mirror when you're ugly. The mirror is just there to reflect the problem. The law says you need Christ. And you say, yes, I need Christ. What Luther then wouldn't say is, now therefore go and live like this. Why? Well, as I was saying our last time, he is concerned that if soon as you add the now therefore into the text or into your sermon, that people will then go back to their works righteousness models. Again, he was hyper allergic to this. That's probably the best word I could think of, because he doesn't always react to the language of works, but as soon as someone brings it up and he doesn't like it, he's like, how dare you? And it's like the very bombastic, that is righteousness and self-righteousness, etc. Very much opposed to it. Other traditions, Reformed especially, it's called the third use of the law, is a massively important thing. And that is rather the will and the Holy Spirit, the Holy Spirit coming into one's will, rather, is to say, and the law now becoming a freedom to us, no longer under its burden, as I like to say, now adopted as children in the household of God. In fact, that is actually the ultimate doctrinal difference. Luther has no doctrine of adoption. Rather, he has, you are justified and you must be sanctified by the same principles of your justification. In Reformed faith and others, you are justified, you're then adopted as sons or daughters of the King. Now, therefore, go and live into the reality of what it means to be a child of God, freed. And as those of you who have adopted children or know those who have, depending on the age of the child, you know there's an accommodation that has to happen. They wonder, do they really belong in this house, even though they know they're adopted? Will you throw me out if I screw up one more time? And the life of love means that the adopted child knows, no, I belong here. This is my house. You are my family. And therefore, they're accommodated to the rules, to the law, you might say, of the house. But it's as a child, not as one who is imprisoned under the law. Luther has none of that. So lots of traditions talk about the Christian life, but what happens with Methodism is it, in this new world, is it syncs up with, again, individualism and moral choice, and it becomes something different. And it syncs it up in a way that there was this new word that's invented called holiness movements. The holiness movements. Now, if there's any two words back-to-back that Luther would be opposed to, it would be a holiness movement. Original sin, by definition, means you're not holy in and of yourself, at least not in terms of one's change. The Wesley and the Methodists, though, come along, and they not only capitalize on the democratization spirit, but they bring in this new question of, as Protestants, shouldn't we be, frankly, better off, more holy than our Catholic counterparts or as those in the world around us? This increasingly becomes an issue as the world around us secularizes. And they go back to Gomorrah in lots of different ways. And the Methodists say, we can live better than the pagans. Good Christian living, good clean living became a phrase in this country as a result, that we're supposed to live better than the pagans. Now, I'm not opposed to holiness here. What I'm saying is when you add holiness to individualism, it becomes, I'm holy, I'm the one who's individually stands above. It becomes like an old illustration from a pastor friend of mine. He was in Israel, down in Jerusalem, just visiting. And he went to the Wailing Wall, because you have to go see it. And he said he saw, the Orthodox Jews praying in their black robes. Or said their black suits, rather, with the hats. That sounds very strange to say it that way, but you know what I mean. They looked like typical praying Orthodox Jews. He said he didn't saw somebody in the same outfit, but it was all spangly white, like perfect white. And he walks up with a folding chair. He lays the folding chair down, and he stands up on it and starts to do the same prayers. And he said, talk about the most self-righteous. He comes in wearing white and steps one step above his brethren just so that he's that much closer to God, just so that he can let everyone know that he's a lot better than them. And he uses this as an illustration of the unique ways we try to set ourselves apart. What the Methodists do when they come along the scene, though, is they say, we can actually achieve sanctification, and we can do it with earnest. You might say it this way. They brought in the language of our experience in the Christian life. They brought in this language of the need for holiness and sanctification. And they diagnosed the problems of Protestantism as a problem of a lack of commitment to the language of sanctification. This is, frankly, one of the biggest ongoing tensions within Protestant theology, Protestant faith, Protestant denominations. It comes into lots of denominations that would even historically not be Methodist. It's that melting pot reality. Wesley, in many ways, embodies this, though. He himself was, I can only tell you, he's anxiety-ridden, much in the same way Luther was. However, when he has his breakthrough or his conversion at Aldersgate, what ends up happening with him, Aldergate's in London, by the way, but he has this breakthrough, and he says, you know what? Now I think I can live unto holiness. Luther did the opposite. His breakthrough was, I can't live this holy life. Wesley has spent most of his years saying, I don't feel like I'm getting on with sanctification, getting on and finding this change in my life. Then he has a breakthrough experience, and he does. And he does lots of very incredible things. I'm certainly not calling him a horrible, despised brother or anything like this. He loved Jesus, but he was anxiety-ridden. One of the examples of this is he and Methodists very, very quickly became consummate, never-ending, high-energy pastors all throughout this country, in the 1700s especially, late 1700s, early 1800s. So much so that the two things that they're, one of the main things to say, that they're known for are horses. There's always a picture of a Methodist getting on a horse everywhere you look. If you go to Savannah, you'll see some of this same kind of iconography of the Wesleyan movement, Asbury and others. And that energy is driven by this idea of change. It's driven by this idea of change. So much so that here's the stat, that in 1776, in this country, there were only 20 Methodist churches. By 1890, there were 20,000. It is the largest single explosion of denominations. This is why there's a Methodist church everywhere. I don't know if you've noticed this. Every part of the South especially. I mean, I lived in a tiny little town of like 9,000 people, and there was still a big Methodist church right in the middle of it. Why? Because of this stat and more besides it. What is driving that, though? Is it just they were active? No, other denominations were very active as well. What's driving it is that in this world, the things I've already talked about, democratization, individualism, the kind of American spirit, synced up perfectly with this language of holiness and moral change and do-goodism. And it exposed a reality within the old world Protestant faith, which is that we were very much in favor of works and the fruit of the faith, as long as you don't focus on them the way the Catholic Church did. But what had not necessarily been the case in Protestant theology is that we had stronger language as to what prevents someone from going to perfectionism. It's one thing to say, I need to be concerned about sanctification and mortification of my sins. It's one thing to say that. It's another thing to say, I think I can get it done before I go to heaven. It's a different reality. And Wesley does have that level of optimism. He even uses the phrase Christian perfection, that there could be a Christian perfectionism in this life. Now, he does to his, now I will say again, to his credit, he says that is by the Spirit. He doesn't believe it's by our own effort. He's just an optimist. He thinks it's going to happen, that you're going to progress, and by the end of your days, you're going to see change. That all synced up. Now, the problem, here's the deal. The problem with believing in perfectionism is not just that you don't read the Bible. It's not just that you don't know the gospel. The problem with perfectionism is that you can't achieve it. So the two things that happen, and this is the next point in a second, the two things that happen whenever you believe that you're going to reach a level of spiritual awesomeness is either you lessen the bar of what it means to be spiritually perfect so that you can actually achieve it, or you continue on with the stupid stuff that is still sinful, but you deny that you're actually the one doing it. This is the Corinth problem. You either say, I can continue on with this lifestyle because my spirit is untouched by such things, I can sleep with whomever I want. Or you say, no, actually, the bar is down here now, and I can get over, it's like the little T-ball thing, I can jump over that hurdle, I don't have to get up here to the actual measure of the law. And so what you end up saying is basically, as long as I don't touch alcohol, I got it. in this world. As long as I don't do fill in the blank. There's always a short set of things. Very simple to accomplish. You know what those holiness movements never do? Count their steps on Sabbath. Actually try to keep the law. Actually do it the way the Pharisees thought they were. They've reduced the bar way down. Now, why is this a tension? Again, the tension is, how do we encourage the Christian life when you have a world that says you individually can choose your own Christian life the way you want it? You see, if we were back in the old world and we were all very communal and we all sort of had this world together, the interconnectedness of the ancient world, the medieval world, what would end up happening is that level of Christian living would be lived out together. Some of you are even old enough to remember this whole thing where, like, all the moms in the neighborhood were kind of everybody's, like, surrogate mom. Like, if they caught you doing something, they'd punish you as well. I mean, that times a million is the Reformation era. Nowadays, it's don't even look at my kid if they're being evil because you have to pretend like you don't see it. You know, this whole thing. Very individualistic now. Only increasingly so. In this day and age, when you have individualism, encouraging perfectionism just means whatever you think perfectionism is, do it. And it becomes the kind of, I'm not making fun of it, but if you go to Lifeway books, it's the self-help section of this Christian spirituality. It becomes five easy ways to get things done, to have, you know, to achieve a certain presence with God, that kind of thing. It becomes a less than biblical pattern of the actual Christian life, masquerading as holiness. So where did all this come from? Where did all this language of holiness and individualism come from? It actually came from probably the single biggest issue in the Protestant faith that was a tension that still comes up all the time, is what is the role of experience? Put it another way around is, how much do you have to experience the faith emotionally, personally, versus how much do you have to confess with your mouth and know? The classic head-heart dichotomy, the tension. Everyone feels it. I always start this out by pointing out that the Bible is not head versus heart. There's actually nothing in the scriptures that push that line. Rather, the Bible will say equally, you know this in your mind, but you don't apply it in your heart and with your hands. And you know this personally and you believe it and you're on the milk, but why aren't you on the meat now? Well, you should know better than this by now. You should study the faith by now. You should know your Bibles better than this. The Bible can condemn you equally about not applying it and feeling it and not knowing it at the same time. So the head-heart dichotomy is a Western invention, frankly. We put these things at odds with each other, I should say. I mean, just be a professor and let me tell you all the comments you get about being completely impractical and irrelevant to people. It happens all the time because the idea is that if you study anything, you kill it. You know, cemetery, seminary, that whole thing. It's only half true. Okay. Where did all this come from? Well, it actually came out of Lutheranism. There's a movement called Lutheran Pietism. Lutheran Pietism is in the 17th century, the 1600s especially, and well into the next century beyond. So if you think basically Westminster Confession of Faith time until the American colonial era, that arc in there, that's Lutheran Pietism. And Lutheran Pietism is the great solvent that brought all this together. It allowed the kind of old world Protestant justification by faith language to marry with perfectionism and individualism and mix together and become, frankly, evangelicalism as you and I know it. That's why we actually, as historians, invented a new word called evangelicalism. It's not because we got bored with the word Protestant. It's because what has happened in this new world looks different than it did in the old. And Lutheran Pietism is the solvent. It is the thing that allows us to mix the melting pot stuff together. Lutheran Pietism came out of the Lutheran Church several generations on. And it took about 120 years itself to really flesh out. But what happened is in the Lutheran faith, by the early 1600s especially, and certainly right about the year 1700, there was this language of, you know what, we have lots of good confessions and lots of doctrine. But what we don't have is a personal faith. And there were a couple of pastors especially that felt disillusioned with their own preaching. That's a hard call, by the way, if you're a pastor and you disillusion yourself with your preaching. But that's exactly what happened. They thought they were preaching only doctrinal very doctrinaire, you might say, sermons, that they were boring people, that they were making it all about zig and zag intellectually the right way. And what they began to say is, why don't we talk about the Christian life? Now, as Lutherans, they knew you don't talk works. They knew that if you bring up the language of, well, I my Christian life is I go do blank. I serve the poor, I do the whatever it is. They knew that was that door was closed. So they crawled in through the window of experience. And they said, ah, I know. Instead of talking about works, let's go inward. Let's talk about the emotional life. Let's talk about the inward life. Let's talk about my faith, not as the faith in Christ, but of the faith that I have, the faithfulness of myself, the emotional integrity of my faith. Now, I'm going to say right now, that's not a bad thing, by the way. Not a bad thing. The problem, though, is what ends up happening when you have a new movement is it very often wants to eclipse and push away what they had before. And so this Lutheran pietism comes along and it says, we want to actually get away from doctrine because doctrine is cold and dead. We want to get away from that type of theologizing and confessionalizing. And instead, we want to go inward. We want to be about the personal life. And they invented three things that all of your churches do. Personal Bible study, small groups, and personal interpretation of the Bible. These all come from Lutheran pietism. Prior to the 17th century, in other words, nobody, just about nobody, I should say, certainly before the Reformation, but by and large, for 1,700 years of church history, nobody had a personal Bible. It was an impossibility, by and large. For most of the Middle Ages, the cost of making a Bible would have been the cost of a medium to large house. Just think of all the sheepskin, the cowskins one would need, the animals you would need to kill to actually make enough of the parchment paper itself. My son was trying to ask me about this, and I said, well, you only get one page per cow butt, son. You don't get to make multiple pages out of the skin. So that means you have to keep killing them. The stat is you would need about 3,000 or so sheep or multiple hundred cows if their skin came off perfectly. You then had to stretch it and scrape. It was just a gross process. You then had to write it all out by hand. All those things. So that's why it was so expensive in the Middle Ages, which, by the way, is why they chained them up. They don't chain up things that no one wants. You chain up the expensive stuff, and they chained them up in libraries because people would walk off with them. But no one had Bibles up until roughly the 1700s. 1650, probably, we're starting to see a lot more. You hear stories of personal Bibles, but that's still the wealthy, the elite, the nobles. What happens, though, is literacy goes up, and the capacity to have your own personal Bibles becomes a reality. As a result, Lutheran pietism says, you know what we need? Personal Bible studies, group Bible studies, devotional life, these types of things. And this is the very first time, particularly 1650 on, where you see devotional literature being published. You actually do not have this before, almost never, but after that you do. You start getting wonderful things like Spurgeon's Morning and Evening and things like that. Again, this is not a bad thing by any means. This is why all denominations have taken this on. But you have to realize that what ends up happening is that just further becomes a solvent. Because what ends up happening is your average John and Jane Doe layperson, they're not going to say, how can we theologize about this? They're going to say, what does this text mean to me? When I read that, what do I feel like? Again, not necessarily a bad thing. You actually have to respond as a Christian, and at least they're asking a responsive question. But again, it detaches the person from the heritage, the history of the faith, that type of thing. This is, by the way, the world I grew up in. I grew up Assemblies of God. It was very much an experiential faith that way. What ends up happening is it becomes, as long as you have the feels good about what you're doing, you're fine. And growing up, I reflected on this much later in life. I remember hearing stories, recalled stories, as to say, of people justifying all kinds of wickedness based off of the Lord has told me so. One of my mom's friends was getting divorced and living with another man because, the Lord had led her to fall in love with somebody else, that type of language. Very much, if one is inclined to it, if they feel it, then it's enough. So you can see, obviously, the problem here. As I say, the problem is that eventually whatever you feel like you want to do. As long as it gives you that thrill up the leg, then you got it. And again, you take that and you marry it into individualism, and there's democracy, the democratization spirit. Am I describing any of your backgrounds, by the way? I'm sure I am. Yeah, I see nods. Okay, yes. Exactly. This is exactly what it feels like. It's me, myself, and I in Jesus, or me and the Bible in the corner with Jesus. I don't need anybody else. That type of thing. This then connected up with holiness and revival movements, which became one of the hardest to understand movements for me as a student, but I've begun to get my arms around it. Holiness and revival movements. Now, again, coming out of a holiness revival movement like Assemblies of God, I just thought this was a quintessentially American style of worship. And it is in some ways, but it's not just about worship. It's rather the focus of what worship is for. You see, if you were to attend church, if you do attend church, or if you were to come to this church or to another Presbyterian church or another church of a traditional stripe of Protestantism, you're going to actually be led through a liturgy. You're going to be led through things that have been done since the beginning, as far back as we know at least. Things like you come in, you pray, you confess your sins, you hear the grace of God, you hear the sermon, you do the sacraments, all those things. We might differ on some of those pieces or different styles, but it's going to look very much the same. If you go to a holiness and revival movement, it's not like that as often, depending on what century we're talking about. Often these would be outdoor, big tent-type sermons that were anti-establishment. This is why they tended to be rejected. Wesley and others would go to a city, and they would say, hey, can I preach in your church? And the pastor would say, no, I don't know who you are, go away. Just get out. And so what they do is they go to a field, and they would call everyone out that way. Very anti-establishment in many ways. Wesley seems to have thought that the way he was preaching would inspire holiness, and that he himself, as it is true, he himself was so restrained about abusing or manipulating the emotions of his people that he thought he was just simply holding out the Christian life as the positive of where he was going to go. This is the First Great Awakening, as we call it. You don't have to know all those details, but this is the First Great Awakening. Within a generation, though, we have the Second Great Awakening, and a man by the name of Charles Finney comes on the scene. Finney in the fields. Finney cares about the fields within your life, and he cares about your experience. And he takes the Wesleyan movement and he says, not only is this something that is a positive, I can actually manipulate it. And he actually encourages spiritual manipulation, emotional manipulation in the context of worship. And he does it through something called the anxious bench, which sometimes that word always sounds funny. Yeah, when I was growing up, we called time out the anxious bench, which is not, that's the punishment bench in some ways. But the anxious bench would be as if there were a bench down here at the front. And if I were preaching a sermon in one of these revivals, what would end up happening is if somebody felt as if they were on the verge of a spiritual breakthrough. Notice that language. On the verge of a spiritual breakthrough. One, I don't know how you would know it, other than one wants it. But if you felt like you were on the verge, you would come and sit at the anxious bench. And what would then happen is the sermon would stop, and then all eyes would focus on the person. They would all put their hands out, whatever it might be, and they would all begin to pray individually for the person now at the anxious bench that the Holy Spirit would fall and that they would have a Pentecost-type experience. Now, I'm going to say this very boldly. As a Calvinist, I believe God did, in fact, use those types of experiences and those types of things to bring people to faith. This is straight out of Westminster, that God is free to go above, beyond, against, or with our efforts in evangelizing in the gospel. And all God's pastors said amen to that, because, you know, there are times you preach a sermon, you think you're Spurgeon, and people go, that's fine, pastor, thank you. And there are times where you feel like you just barely, you know, got your shoes tied before you got up there, and you did your best, and it wasn't great, and someone comes up to you weeping, and you're like, well, I didn't even really pay half attention to myself. I don't know what happened, you know, in this whole thing. And I have a student who was brought to faith actually by the worst possible way ever. He was a local guy. He now lived in Atlanta. He was at a little mom and pop church that met about 20 people, very Pentecostal church. He went there. He and his wife just popped in for just to see what it was like. They were neighbors. And the pastor goes, anybody here not a Christian? And of course, he prided himself on the time of being honest. So he raised his hand. He goes, I at the moment regretted it, but now I'm happy that I did. He said, I raised my hand. And the guy said, all right, come on up. And he brought him up and he said, stood him up on the stage and he said, are you willing to accept the Lord right now? My friend said, no. I didn't say I'm ready to. I just said I'm not a Christian. And the pastor goes, all right, you go stand over there on the corner of the stage. I'm going to keep preaching. And he preaches for 20 more minutes. Then he turns around, you ready? No. And he did it over and over and over again for an hour. This is a long Pentecostal service. They're always late to the lunch restaurants when I was growing up for the long sermon. And he kept doing it. Finally, he was like getting angry. He just said, well, he was angry to begin with, but he was getting like visceral. And he finally said, fine. And so he did the sinner's prayer and stuff. And he said he didn't believe it, didn't think it. He gets back to his apartment afterwards, and he's on the verge of tears in the kitchen by himself. And it was his girlfriend, now his wife. Knew to leave him alone. She went back in the bedroom, hung out by herself while he was there in the kitchen, angry, weeping. And then he heard God's voice in his head saying, "If I'm not real, why is this making you so mad?" And it was one of those, like, that's Westminster right there. God can work, but even with dumb ideas, God can use it how he wants. And so God used Fenny, I'm sure. There were lots of stories of revival. It's fine. What ended up happening with the anxious bench, though, is we do know it's a psychological manipulation. One of the reasons why people hate public speaking is everyone hates it when all eyes point at them. You have to get used to it. Those of you who have preached know this or talked ever at all in public. And whenever all the attention is focused on you, you start to feel like something's wrong. You get very self-conscious. If you haven't had to public speak, you probably felt like this at your wedding, when everyone's just sort of staring at you, like waving. You know, they're very excited for you. You feel self-conscious, right? When you go to the anxious bench and every eye is focused on you, it is manipulative, and you will have an emotional experience from it. That might very well not have anything to do with spiritual renewal or conversion. Notice, by the way, in this picture, and this is a drawing, a painting from the Second Great Awakening with Fenny and them. Does that look like any kind of a service going on there? People slain in the spirit, very Pentecostal. This is 150 years before Azusa Street and the rise of charismatic and Pentecostal faith, which when you look at Pentecostal and charismatic faith, it comes straight out of these same things. The reason Azusa Street and others got national attention is not because they were Pentecostal, it's because they were mixed ethnically. It was a black pastor leading a mixed congregation, and the LA Times came out to focus on the scandal of that crap. And they made fun of it and tried to mock it into breaking up the church. But this is the uniquely American style of emotional experiential worship. It is very much who we are. Is it bad? No, of course not. Heaven forbid anyone say, I don't want to emotionally be invested in my faith. You have to learn how to affirm before you critique. But in this case, what happens is the emotional side pushes straight into two things. Emotional abuse and burnout, and a radical stance against culture and power that is something we're still dealing with even today. And if on the first hand, that revival stuff by Fenny becomes overwhelmingly the focus of American Christianity for about 125 to 150 years. From roughly 1776, which is a date hopefully we can all remember, up until about 150 years after that, this type of revivalism, this emotional excess of our style of worship, the idea that you're always falling away, coming back, actually led to a staggering amount of burnout. Because there, in other words, in the early Reformation, there is perceived by some to be not enough focus on Christian living, that when they got about Christian living stuff in the Methodist movements and others, they just made that the only thing that they focused on. And no one in that day had experienced manipulation or burnout in that level in that way, and it became this tension that we have inherited as a result. And if you don't think that the Finneyism stuff is still around, we don't do anxious bench, but we do all kinds of things in the broader Protestant evangelical world. I have a friend who's a worship pastor. He went to a worship conference once, and they told him, if revival breaks out and people come down and are kneeling and during the altar call, do not change the key of the song or they will get up and leave. that if you keep it on the same key, there is something emotionally, mentally that they know to stay in that position. If you then change it up and switch keys, you feel like something has changed and you want to get up and go. That's Finneyism, that's manipulation, that's exactly what we're talking about. What this led to, though, is a place called the Burned Over District. This is there in Jersey. It's still, I mean, this is Jersey now. These are the counties that we're talking about. The Burned Over District is some strange nexus point where all the circuit preachers and revival preachers that went everywhere kind of willy-nilly, this area becomes the most revivaled, if you want to make up a new word, the most revivaled area in all of North America. More revival sermons and big tent meetings happened here during that 150 years than anywhere else. Today, it is one of the least Christianed areas in North America. They had gotten to the point where they had heard enough, and that nothing actually changed, that it was the same kind of ratcheting up each time, and it kept getting more and more emotional, but less and less real, less and less applicable, as I was saying before, less and less ordinary in the day-to-day life. That's one. So the other piece, though, is that when you get to the last thing I'll talk about, Protestants in power, that same holiness stuff, that same Christian experience stuff, again, it wasn't that it wasn't talked about in Protestant faith, but it wasn't our focus, so that when it comes on, it becomes this new animal. The other thing that it relates to is the question of power. What Protestantism did not deal with, we don't have a lot of resources, I should say, within Protestant theology, is how do we deal with the world around us when we're not in charge? How do we deal with the world around us when we do get in charge? Both questions, believe it or not, are somewhat the same. What do you do when you're persecuted? Well, there's not a lot of that language necessarily. There's some of it, sure. But what do you do when you're actually the majority of a certain community, or you have the opportunity to offer change? I don't just mean political power. I just mean power, influence. And what happens is in the American culture, in our Protestant inheritance, up until 1900 and a little bit beyond, is Americans believe one of two things. Either we should have the power and the influence and the say-so in this country, therefore we will take strategies to get it back. Or we never should have had it, therefore Jesus is going to come any day now and we just need to wait for glory. Believe it or not, both come from the exact same instinct. It's a confusion about how we relate to the world around us and the power around us. The great example of this would be Henry Miller and the Millerites. It sounds like a Motown group, but still, Henry Miller and the Millerites are a phenomenal example of this tension. Henry Miller is a man, he's actually Baptist, and he comes straight out of that Burned Over District. He was revivaled over and over and over again. And what he came to believe is that Christ was set to return in the year 1843. He's the forerunner to Harold Camping and other people like that. Before him, Hal Lindsey, and before him, blah, blah, blah. By the way, as a historian, I can tell you there has never been a generation where there isn't somebody saying he's coming back now. If that gives you any comfort to stop listening to them, please take it. This has always been the case. Occasionally, you get people like Miller, though, who actually get everyone listening. Miller believed it was 1843. The reason being, he took Daniel's 2,300 days, and he said, well, of course, a year is like a day to the Lord, therefore it's going to be 2,300 years. And therefore, he found a date that happened to coincide with the 2,300 years ended in his lifetime. Notice, by the way, the future, the people who predict Christ's coming, they don't say he's coming back in 150 years. It's always like 150 days. It's always immediate because it gets this going. He also became a bit of a PR campaign. This actually hit the flyer he sent out with all the explanations as to what the prophecies meant. Now, what's the point of all this? Here's the deal. When Henry Miller started to say this, it was during a time when American Christianity became increasingly under fire by secularists. The 1840s to the 1890s is when you see the rise of Darwinianism, you see the rise of secularism, scientism, a real kind of a science with a big S as a philosophy that has to attack faith, that type of thing. I mean, the inventor of the study, or the founder of the study of geology, for example, famously said, I have started this field so that we can dethrone Moses. I mean, it's an antagonism from start to finish in the 1800s. And as there is this sense of a loss of cultural capital, there becomes this, Jesus is nigh, we're not long for this world, he is coming, come quickly, Lord Jesus. And you begin to see this idea that if one keeps holy enough, that he will come back and you'll be one of the raptured out now, immediate folks. In other words, rapture language, immediate return of Christ language, always comes with the sense of a loss of something around you. We have lost it, Christ is coming back. Or if we believe it enough, we will gain some traction back before he, with the time is short, we only have a few years, give now so that we can establish this ministry, that type of stuff. It's always that way, and it always has been that way. Henry Miller and the Millerites led to the Great Disappointment, great name for the end of a movement, the Great Disappointment of the 22nd, maybe this ought to be what we celebrate in October, as the wakening up of Christianity. But the Great Disappointment, and I don't mean to tease, but and thankfully Henry Miller repented of the language. He was doing his honest best. He was reading the Bible, but he had no training. And this is the American spirit. I have no training, but I have a premonition. I have insight. Therefore, whatever idea I have in my head is fine. The Great Disappointment, though, was October 22nd, 1844. He and others went out into the field waiting for the return of Christ. And you kind of get that. But, you know, as the sun goes down, the crickets start to come out, and they're going, Henry, anything going on here, buddy? And nothing happened, obviously. Jesus did not come back. If you need me to tell you that Jesus didn't come back in 1844, you need help, because he didn't. So he didn't come back, but what was happened is there becomes this spill out. People say, you know what? We can't do this anymore. There were all types of theories. One of the groups that came out of it were the Shakers. You probably have some piece of furniture in this church or in your house that was invented or inspired by their woodworking. The Shaker furniture was very famous. Well, the Shakers are one of these groups that came out of this Great Disappointment. The holiness movement, the apocalyptic movement, if you were to say two things that are at the core right now of American Protestantism, it's apocalypticism and holiness and revivals. Those three things, I should say. That is the very essence. Strangely enough, what ends up happening again, though, is the bar gets lowered. Not true holiness biblically, but rather healthy living becomes the goal. If you don't believe me, this is very much the case. There's a famous Battle Creek Sanatorium. The Battle Creek Sanatorium, this is just one example of it. But this is the most famous example, where Christian holiness became associated with spa life, healthy living, getting away from the smog of the city and going out and cleansing oneself, detoxing in that sense. There was, during the same time, a rise of vegetarianism. What we call hippie California culture, by the way, is predominantly 18th century or 1800s, as they say, American evangelical culture that's just left Jesus behind. Evangelicals in this time went very granola, very health, wealth. Is that new? No, it's very old. Not that recent, I should say. Health, wealth. Battle Creek Sanatorium, though, was by J.C. Penney and Montgomery Ward, both avowed Christians who said, you know what, we're going to actually use our money to fund this type of health. Many of you will be aware of Penny Farms, just to the south of Jack's. It's a wonderful place for retirement. They take care of people all the way to the end of life. It's a concern for that. Not a bad thing. But why would you create these things? Why would you be concerned about them? You're concerned about them because in the absence of actual holiness, the desire becomes, I know, we'll just live healthy lives, and that will be good Christian living, and that will be the standard of holiness. It's a not true holiness. It becomes what is maintained. This, by the way, becomes even more quirky in the YMCA movement and the movement of what we call muscular Christianity. Yes, I said muscular Christianity. It's exactly how it sounds. I don't know how that guy is doing that on that ladder, by the way, but it's pretty awesome. It's this idea, this idea that to be a Christian, one must be virile, strong. You can't be asthmatic and weak. That health and holiness are synonymous. And therefore, economic health and holiness are synonymous as well. God wants you to be, fill in the blank, healthy, wealthy. Why? You're going to increase in the quality of your life. And this leads, by the way, to white Jesus syndrome. That picture, by the way, does exist. That's not a mock. It exists at the Holy Land Experience down in Orlando, if you go see it. big 1980s hair, this kind of stuff. The idea of white Jesus, the sexy Jesus stuff. I mean, the beefy saint. This is Christianity. This becomes American Christianity in the early 1900s. The idea that what Christianity is here to do is to empower you, not save you, you who are lack power, but rather to empower you to be more like the Oprah Jesus, this self-affirming, strengthening faith. So all that stuff that you think is relatively new is actually a further spiraling out of so many of these tensions I've been talking about so far. All this stuff with what I call white Jesus comes out of one book in the 1940s, Bruce Barton's The Man Nobody Knows. And he actually says, look, if we are to be made into Christ's image, that means he must have a six-pack. I mean, he literally says this. He must have this set of beautiful bronze skin, blue eyes. Of course, he creates the Aryan dream impression of things, etc. What I always say is that becomes the origin of this stuff. If you go back, for example, to the Middle Ages and you see art where they're painting Christ and Jesus looks like a European guy, they know he's not Semitic. They know he's not European and that he's Semitic. The problem is they've never met anybody who's Semitic, probably. So they had their friend Bob step in and they painted his picture whenever they were doing it. They knew who Jesus was. This is literally, though, saying, Jesus must look like me, be me, and everything I want to be. It is pure wish fulfillment at this point. The tension has now becoming almost caustic. It's eroding who we are. And then finally, the language of temperance, not finally, I should say, but the language of temperance, the language of that Christians are opposed to alcohol, opposed to all types of specific things. Alcohol is just one example. The picture on the right is my favorite, by the way. It is meant to be a spoof. They're looking grumpy on purpose. You can see it in her face. She's clearly doing it silly. This lady here is the famous temperance fighter. She would walk around with a big chopping axe over her shoulder, which you see in the cartoon picture, to break down the barrels. Now, here's the thing. Alcoholism was a massive problem then, far more so than it is today. The women were right to stand up and say, stop it. Men would go from the factories to the bars and stay there for 4 hours to come home roaring drunk. And there was a world where you don't shame anybody, so the pastors were not stepping in and saying stop. And so the women rose up and said, you need to stop. You're destroying us, destroying the families. Now, the outcome was not necessarily great. It just gave rise to bootleg liquor and mafia. But still, you couldn't control it that way either. However, the language here is what? Holiness, healthy, change. God wants to empower you, equip you, make you better than you think you could ever be. It becomes, in other words, the origins of a Joel Osteen message. The simple happiness that you were supposed to have is the faith. Did Protestantism invent that? I would say no doctrinally. But the changing tensions of our cultures is what gave rise to it. Which is why I think it can be very offensive and affronting, is you can see how they got there, but you're so mad that we have landed there, this kind of self-empowerment. And so, end of this. The idea is that you have lost influence. And you either, we're not long for this world, we're going to get raptured, so therefore don't care about this world. I mean, I've heard pastors on the radio, on TV say, this is the Titanic, it's going down, why would you polish the brass, don't worry about this world, you're going to go to heaven, he might be back any day now. I mean, talk about a lack of salt and light in the world around you. There's no cause to do anything then. On the other hand, you hear this, hey, for the low price of $9.99, I'll send you this snake oil, and you can just apply it to your car, and you'll never have a car accident. This kind of empowerment language, this kind of guruism language, which makes it feel like we're back in Corinth very often. Okay, if that's thoroughly depressing to you, I'm 5 minutes over. If that's thoroughly depressing to you, come back after lunch. There is a glass half full side to the story, which is the future, where things are going. As Protestantism has gone global, the globe has looked back at us and said, you people are crazy right now. Like, how about this as the Orthodox faith, as the substance of what you need? Namely, the global world has said, only people who wish they were wealthy actually pray that God will make them wealthy. When you don't have that option, you don't go to health, wealth, that type of thing.